Welcome to the Holistic Wealth Podcast. I'm your host, Keisha Blair, wife, mother of three, author of Holistic Wealth, and founder of the Institute on Holistic Wealth. The show will showcase various experts in the key pillars of holistic wealth. Each week, we deliver the best information on how to become holistically wealthy and live your best life. And Andre is the author of All the White Friends I Couldn't Keep, Hope and Hard Pills to Swallow About Making Black Lives Matter. And Andre, it's so amazing to have you here. Social justice is a big part of holistic wealth. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And so I want to dive into the inspiration for this book.
So the book tells the story of how I started, or my political awakening and my journey into activism, and really how I started writing songs about politics, you know, whereas before I was mostly writing about, you know, love and relationships and romance and all that kind of stuff. But the Black Lives Matter movement really, it drew a line in the sand for me where I started asking, you know, how can I really participate in the struggle for Black freedom? And when, as I was going through that process and starting to write more songs about these things and starting to speak up and write about these things, I had a lot of white friends that I had acquired throughout my life, people that I considered like family, that became like my biggest opposers. You know, I was surprised by that because these are people that I loved, you know, and I just assumed that, you know, that if there were a new civil rights movement, then they would be, you know, on the front lines with me. But it turned out that weren't. So I wrote an open letter to them one day in 2019, because a few had been online saying, you know, Andre's a racist now, and Andre hates white people and all these things. And I said, no, you can't say that without a receipt. You know, you have to show where I actually said that, you know, and there would be no place because I never said that. So I decided that I would write a receipt of my love for them, which was an open letter that I called To All the White Friends I Couldn't Keep. And I wrote, you know, to them, and I explained, you know, like, I am not hateful. The reason why we are separated is not because of hate, but because you refuse to listen to me. So a literary agent got a hold of that blog and reached out to me because he felt like I could write a book based on that blog. And that's how the book came about, really. Although as I was working on it, I decided that I didn't want to just expand that blog post into, you know, a book long letter to all those people that I wrote to, because by the time the book came about, I had moved on from trying to convince white people of the things that we are saying. You know, I wanted to write a book that would speak to me, the version of myself that needed that book 8 years ago. You know, what are the things that I wish that I had at my fingertips about social change, about racism, and about dealing with this kind of opposition? And so that's how I wrote the book, was writing, you know, to people who are in the place that I was 8 years ago.
I don't know if you know, Andre, what's happening in Canada right now as we speak, with the truckers' protest and the convoy and what happened right here in my own city where I lived in Ottawa. And luckily, they've been able to clear the roads now. So the roads are clear, but it was unbelievable. I actually had a dream the night before that there were cars going through the city with Confederate flags. And that's what ended up happening. And our kids are struggling with it as they see it on the media, and racial slurs being hurled at police and the media. And I just want to get your sense of where we stand at this moment in time, where we have, you know, books being banned in libraries across the United States. And we're struggling both in the United States and in Canada with these issues. And these issues are real. They're affecting us as Black people.
And I write about this in my book. You know, first off, I think that a lot of people don't understand that racism is a global system. Anti-Blackness is a global problem, right? And it stems from, you know, European imperialism, right? That white countries, these white kingdoms went around the whole world dominating indigenous land and displacing, exiling African people to different parts of the world, built societies on this lie of race and human hierarchy and inferiority. And so we have to take that as the base level, right? That many of these nations were built espousing democratic ideals, but in practice were deeply anti-democratic to begin with, right? And when we start there, then for America, for example, the imperial ideology of America is that America's land of the free, home of the brave, a beacon of democracy throughout the world. But the truth is that America's politics have always been deeply anti-democratic along the color line. When we take that as the base of the story, then we understand that America, like many other nations, was founded as a white supremacist state. It experiences freedom movements from time to time that cause it to adjust its laws, right, and adjust its policies to extent. But that initial democratic, anti-democratic practice, that tradition always wants to course correct itself. And so what you see in response to any type of progress toward a fuller and more robust democracy is always followed by fascist counter-revolutions. And right now, what we're seeing in the world is a blowback, a backlash, or counter-revolutions, anti-democratic counter-revolutions, white supremacist, fascist counter-revolutions all over the world, because we had a global uprising for Black lives 2 years ago. And so there are people in many of these nations that were founded on the live human hierarchy that are invested in the status quo, that are invested in things staying that way. And they don't want for us to talk about the truth of how these nations were built and the atrocities that were executed in order to build these nations. They don't want for us to talk about these things. And so the book bannings and the protests and, you know, all the hysteria about critical race theory and all these things are a part of that impulse of those who belong to these dominant classes, alleged dominant classes, wanting to keep things the same way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Andre, you grew up in Georgia, right? In the shadows of Stone Mountain, right? Confederate Mount Rushmore. I mean, this experience started for you relatively young. Can you tell us what that was like?
Yes, of course. You know, I tell people that in Stone Mountain, because it's a part of the Metro Atlanta area, there is a convergence of two very different streams. It is the place where the Ku Klux Klan was reborn in America. It is also the capital city of the civil rights movement, you know, which makes sense because, you know, it's like Frantz Fanon says in his book, A Dying Colonialism, that where there is oppression, that oppression will determine the sites of resistance. And so that's why you have this convergence of those two places, but of those two streams, basically. But what I'm saying about Stone Mountain and growing up there is that you have the largest Confederate monument in the country there, right? You have it. Basically, there's a theme park around it. And every year people go there and they watch, you know, the laser show where they outline the generals, the Confederate generals that are carved into the side of Stone Mountain, and they make them move again, right? And people are clapping and cheering and hooting and hollering, and they don't see this instance as a characteristic of the culture of Stone Mountain, that the spirit of the Confederacy is alive and well. You know, when you told the story about seeing Confederate flags in Canada, immediately I thought, oh wow, like it reminded me this is still a global problem, and the spirit of the Confederacy and what it represents of about white dominance, about white privilege, is very much alive and well in the world. And so nobody wanted to talk about that history in Stone Mountain. And so when I would talk about experiences of prejudice or racism that I experienced as a child, you know, older white adults would, you know, say things like, you're playing the race card, and, you know, don't bring that into it. And racism is a heavy word. It's a strong word, you know. And they kind of police the way that I'm talking about my experiences and thinking about my experiences and trying to, basically what I talk about is gaslighting. They're gaslighting me in that story. And so that is kind of what it was like, is that you have something as big as Stone Mountain that represents the Confederacy. It literally has the Confederate generals carved into the side of it. But everyone wants to pretend that it's not consequential that the KKK was started here and that, you know, that the history has been revised. Everyone wants to just say, okay, let's just all get along and, you know, not see color and things like that.
You're also a musician and an artist, Andre. And what part has that played in terms of your social activism? I mean, we share a common love for Bob Marley, and I grew up on Bob Marley, as I'm sure you did. And he was a great social activist as well for the times that he lived in. And I'm just wondering if you can tell us about that part of your life and what role that plays.
Well, yeah, you know, Bob Marley is the first activist I ever learned about. And I, you know, I love music from a young age. And I discovered Bob Marley's music in my parents', you know, vinyl collection. I listened to the Wailers album, Burning and Lootin', you know, that album. I listened to it every day. And Get Up, Stand Up, I Shot the Sheriff in particular were two songs that I listened to every single day. They just resonated. And then I found out that Bob Marley, that he got paid to make music when I was in fourth grade. And I said, wow, like, I didn't know that was a job. You know, I think that that is what I would want to do when I grow up, right? And Bob Marley's vision, you know, for social justice, or his prophetic, you know, kind of persona really resonated with me from an early age. So it's always been a part of, you know, my upbringing. Also, my father is a reggae musician and he was an activist and all these things. And so, you know, for me, and I was just talking to someone about this other day, and I wonder, you know, if it resonates as true for you. It never occurred to me that music was something separate from a force for social good and for social progress in the world. Because I think that when you grow up listening to reggae music, you know, reggae music is politically aware. It is conscious music often. You know, and there are often themes about social justice and social awareness and Black empowerment and all these things in the music. And I think it's part of a larger tradition in the Caribbean, too, because I've been, you know, when I was writing the book, I was listening to a lot of old calypso music, like calypso music from the 30s and 40s and 50s. And you know, the calypsonians, they are telling the news in the music, and they are making social commentary about things, you know, in the news, about the Russian satellite and about the death of Martin Luther King Jr. and all these kinds of things. And they're doing it to this music that is just so upbeat and makes you want to move. And so I know I'm talking a lot on this question, but, you know, all those things are kind of mixed in for me from the beginning. So like I said, when the Black Lives Matter movement really drew a line in the sand for me, I had already been making music all that time. And so I decided that I wanted to write songs. I wanted to write songs now to, you know, participate in the movement in that way. And so that's when my music started to change, and I started going to, you know, these clubs in LA that I was playing in. And I would look, you know, I was lugging a 100-pound boulder around with me to show the weight of systemic racism. And I would, you know, bring it to the clubs that I was playing in and bring it on stage with me and sing, you know.
That's amazing. And I want to pick up on that point, Andre, because I saw that on social media, on Twitter, actually, about you with that boulder lugging it around. And I thought, wow, I want to hear more about what that was like. What inspired you to do that? And what change do you think happened as a result of that, even within your own circles?
Of course, you know, and I think that a part of this is I entered this work as an artist. Right. And, you know, the lugging this boulder around, people pointed out when I started doing it that, you know, this is performance art that you're doing. And I never thought about it that way to begin with. It just felt like, you know, it came in this moment of inspiration that I talk about in the book, and where I had a vision of me doing this and I felt like I was supposed to do it. So, you know, I did. I found a 100-pound boulder and I had a wagon and I lugged this thing around with me everywhere. And it's 100 pounds. So it's very, you know, it's heavy, you know, I drop it in my car and the whole car buckles under the weight. And I felt like it was very symbolic. You know, it made everything symbolic because people are jumping over it or trying to move around it and all these kinds of things. And with their bodies, they're doing the very things that we do in culture every day. They try to avoid this thing, right? Most people didn't say anything about it. You know, a lot of people didn't. I didn't have a whole lot of conversations with people that I didn't know about it. It just felt like it was a very symbolic thing, you know, and it felt like it drew everybody into the performance. One thing that I did see is that for some people, you know, it clicked for them. They come to understand, you know, that when I walk into a room, when I go to a job interview, when I'm sitting in class, when I go on a date, when I'm doing a show, I don't just forget about, you know, watching people like me die in the news or on Facebook Live or things like that, you know? And I saw people in my social circle, you know, some people understand better, you know, what we were talking about racism. And I even saw some people become active in the movement because they saw me lugging this boulder around. But I also had a couple of people that were close to me that, you know, they felt like I was just stirring up trouble. You know, some of the ones I couldn't keep. I'm just stirring up trouble and, you know, offending people for no reason or whatever. And, you know, my book is all about like finding those people who are with you, you know, people who understand what you're going through or at least want to learn. And so I just, you know, the people who felt like I'm stirring up trouble, I just say, okay, well, that means that, you know, this friendship is, it's not going to go anywhere from here.
You know, it's Black History Month. And I talk about the racial wealth gap a lot. And it's something that is, it's like, you know, Black people have this boulder around walking with symbolically. And we think about it a lot, you know, because I think historically we are raised with this awareness that we need to leave a legacy to the next generation and not let the next generation suffer as much as we did or previous generations. And I want to get your sense of what you think about the racial wealth gap now and where that stands, because that's also a big part of the story in terms of that, you know, when you spoke about dominant and some groups being more dominant and wanting that status quo and not wanting to lose that. A big part of that is that economic wealth portion that is, you know, not wanting to share a piece of the pie, not wanting anybody else to get that, experience that prosperity. And it's something I talk about in my book, Holistic Wealth, especially in this new edition coming up. And I just want to get your sense about that, because that's also very dear to my heart when I think about the anti-racism movement and anti-Black racism and how we can, you know, leave that, you know, next generation better than we are previous generations before us. So if you could share any thoughts on that, that would be great.
It's just about people's attitude and what they say and how they think. And they're not making the connection between these narratives of racial hierarchy and difference and, you know, concrete injustices like what you're talking about with the racial wealth gap, you know, not making the connection between the capitalist system and the capitalist common sense that we live under and the way that that was built through the breaking of Black bodies, right? Some of these things are disconnected for people, and I'm really trying to connect those things for people in the book. You know, I talk about in the first chapter about the, you know, what some people call the Ma'afa, right? The Swahili word for a great disaster or catastrophe, you know, something unimaginably heinous that has happened in the world. It was a crime, you know, that the building of these nations was done, as Dr. King said, the sweat and suffering of Black people. And they don't, and a lot of people are not making the connection that slavery was the economic engine of the so-called New World, the British Empire. So that these white people, these wealthy white people at that time could live large. You know, they're buying luxury goods like coffee and tea and indigo and building large mansions for themselves and all that kind of stuff. And how are they getting this money? Because they're violently exploiting the labor of the African captives that they have on these work camps. You know, people don't understand the global system. And I try to tease that out as well a bit in the book without it feeling like a history lesson, but just talking, you know, connecting it from, you know, trying to connect our story today in the larger story of history. People don't understand, like you and I, our roots are in Jamaica, and people don't understand how important that little island was for the British Empire, how much sugar was produced in Jamaica, and how much wealth was created through those plantations in Jamaica, and how Britain couldn't have become great without exploiting Jamaican land and African labor in Jamaica, and how that system of creating wealth was connected to trade with the American colonies and with Britain. And I'm going deep. But I say all that to say that people don't understand that the whole process of doing this was the creation of white wealth, you know, at the expense of Black life and Black prosperity. And I don't know a lot about Canadian history, but I know that in Jamaica, the people them just up and left with a huge burden, right? They say, okay, you're no longer a colony, but they don't pay reparations to the slave owners' families up until 2015. They just finished paying reparations to the people in the, you know, slave owning families, right? And so somebody asked me a couple years ago, because they're white and they don't know Jamaican history and they didn't realize that they're speaking to a Jamaican person. And he wants to bring up some example and say, well, what responsibility do Black people have to end racism? You know, and then he wants to bring up Jamaica and say, well, Jamaica is a majority Black country and they're poor. And he wants to blame it on a poverty mentality. I say, well, do you know how Jamaica became poor? Do you know how it was underdeveloped? And he doesn't know. What I'm saying is that people don't seem to understand that we are in this position in all these different countries where Black people are overrepresented among the unhoused and the impoverished, more overrepresented in those suffering with mental health issues and with physical health issues and all these things, that these things are directly connected to a history of white nations trying to consolidate wealth and power among rich white people. And our anti-racism efforts and talk and values and all these things are not going to make much of a difference if we're not trying to intervene and remedy, you know, these injustices that have these legacies, like the racial wealth gap. You know, what does it mean to say that you are against racism if we're not trying to pay off student loan debt, you know, and encourage, you know, wealth building among Black people and redistributing it? And this is what Dr. King was talking about a lot from the beginning of his career, you know, but especially near the end, where he is talking so much about poverty. And he basically said, you know, I can't remember which piece this is in, but the book, The Radical King, is in there. There's one time, or actually, I think I read it in a Black political thought reader. But he basically said, you know, we found out that the most direct way to deal with poverty is to just give people money. I say, what a concept, because he's talking about, you know, we have to redistribute the wealth. I say all that to say, so to sum all of that up, you know, racism has always been about economic power. It has always been a tool to achieve this economic stratification. And the only way to deal with racism meaningfully is to think about how do we correct the crime that has been committed against us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I 100% agree, Andre. Like, I'm a trained economist, and I remember when we had the George Floyd protests, and so many companies pledged that they would do, you know, very practical things to help, you know, with anti-Black racism. And they pledged all this money. And when we did some research for, you know, the updated version of Holistic Wealth, I have some stats in there too, at how many companies who pledged actually lived up to those pledges. It was disappointing and just devastating to look at those numbers, because it was more like a performative type pledge with no meaning behind it. And I agree that as an economist, I do believe that the only meaningful way to do this, you know, without completely saying every Black History Month, we're doing the same thing, every year we're doing the same thing, is our redistribution and reparations. You brought up Jamaica, and that's interesting because I know successive politicians in Jamaica too have tried, right? They've gone to Europe and they've said, we need reparations. There's a part in St. Elizabeth, Andre, that there's a in Santa Cruz that has this port, and I think it's called Farquharson's Wharf, that had the most slaves from the Zong massacre that took place during slavery. And I think it was from Scotland, where most of those slaves died on slave ships coming into Jamaica, and they named it Farquharson's Wharf because the slave owners at the time had the Farquharson's name. And that's my family name too, in terms of my grandparents. And it's unbelievable that the Jamaican government had sought reparations just for even that, which is just a minute part of our history, right? That's just one set of slave ships that came in from like Scotland. And that was just a minute part. And it's mind boggling to think about not only how many slaves died, but how Jamaica, the role that Jamaica, as you said, played into enriching those countries. And it's unbelievable, you know, as we sit here and we talk, and it's Black History Month, it's 2022. And I feel like, you know, there's a certain amount of progress that we thought would have happened that hasn't happened. And so, Andre, I'm going to give you the last word as we wrap up this amazing interview.
Yeah, you know, I think that the thing that I really want people to take seriously from the book and take to heart is that, you know, it doesn't have to be this way. This world does not have to be arranged in the way that it is, or it doesn't have to stay this way. And that's what I really write about. That was my main motivation, you know, as I continue to work on the project, is to help people to understand the things that I've learned from going on this journey. Because I didn't know how powerful, you know, organizing for strategic nonviolent struggle could really be. And as I read that literature, I kept thinking to myself, how come everyone doesn't know this stuff? How come it's not taught in school? How come? And we know why, because a population that is informed about its own power is dangerous to those who want to keep people oppressed. That's what I would just want people to know, is that it really doesn't have to be this way, because history is full of stories of ordinary, organized, outraged people who have worked together to fight against oppression and have won, you know. And if the people have done it before, then we can do it again. So I know that, you know, we don't have time to get into all of those things, but, you know, I did put it in the book. Just so you know, I don't get that much money from a book sale. So I'm not saying that so that people buy my book and I put money in my pocket. I won't get much money put in my pocket. But I put all of this stuff in a book so that it would be easy to find. You know, it's not like my book is the only book on these things, but I know that a lot of people are not going to go study these things themselves. So I've made sure that this book is readable. It is easy to read, you know, and I know that it will change people's lives and their perspective if they give it a chance.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is easy to read. It's a great book, Andre. And thank you for working on that project and taking it in hand and putting all the pieces together. And just before we go, can you just tell everyone where to find the book, where to find you, and how to follow you on your different social media platforms?
Kind of follow along with what I'm working on is to go to my website. It's andrehenry.co. And, you know, all my social media is there. I have an email list there. People can join. I used to write every week. Now I'm going to write once a month to people. I did that for 4 years. Keep up. So yes, that's the best way to keep in touch. And I also have a community app, the community app for the cell phone, you know, and, you know, I just send out an encouraging text every Wednesday, you know, through that. But people can also, you know, they can text that number and it does come to my phone. It does reach me, you know, so I, you know, interact with people there. I just don't like do a lot of educating there. It's not a good way, you know, for people to ask me deep questions. You know, it's more like just keeping in touch.
No, that's awesome. And once again, Andre, thank you so much for sharing about your work and your journey and your amazing book with us. It was amazing having you here. Thank you again.
Thank you for joining us this week on Holistic Wealth with Keisha Blair. Make sure to visit our website, KeishaBlair.com, where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, or via RSS so you will never miss a show. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes, or if you simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Are you a member of the Institute on Holistic Wealth? If not, what are you waiting for? Go to InstituteOnHolisticWealth.com/memberships to choose your membership plan and join. As a member, you get so many perks. Free worksheets, advice, coaching, and a member's workshop to design an intentionally designed life. You need to figure out your life purpose? Take the Build Your Life Purpose Portfolio online self-paced course. You're struggling with all your money decisions? Take the free financial identities quiz and then take the course. You recently had a breakup, job loss, or experienced the death of a loved one? Take the holistic healing course. You need an overall plan to achieve holistic wealth? We will help you figure out your holistic wealth blueprint. And of course, if you want to start making money by helping others achieve holistic wealth, become a certified holistic wealth consultant. Regardless of what career you've got, the Institute will show you how to increase your income and walk in your purpose. The sooner you join, the sooner you start to achieve a more holistically wealthy lifestyle. And you're going to want to stay for a very long time. So go to InstituteOnHolisticWealth.com/memberships to join. If you haven't read the book yet, pick up a copy of the award-winning, best-selling Holistic Wealth 32 Life Lessons to help you find purpose, prosperity, and happiness.